fellas want to read me my rights.
You have the right to have your face kicked in by me. You have the right to have your balls stomped by him.
I'll waive my rights.
They're pretty simple. The forms are all standard boilerplate.
Okay, well, we're all hungry. We're gonna get to our hot plate soon enough, all right? But let's talk about the contract here.
Sorry.
You'd be surprised how many doors a letter from a lawyer can open or close.
It seems like you're talking slower since you started charging by the hour.
What's the meaning of this? This is my quiet time.
We're gonna have to take you into custody.
That's outrageous. What am I charged with?
Don't have to tell you anymore. Clearly haven't been reading your Scalia.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 180, and don't touch those dials. We're on early. I don't know why you would. You already saw that. But anyway, don't touch the dial. I'm really excited. We are doing something kind of special because the breaking news, I mean, it's now no longer breaking, but it's, I mean, man, the standards of information today, because we are coming at you with some amazing in-depth analysis of the SCOTUS decision on the Masterpiece Cake Shop. And we're doing it like, you know, 2 days after it happened. And that's like 7,000 years in internet time. But still, it's you wait for OA to give you the accurate information. And that's what we're doing. And even more so because we're doubling our usual Andrew content. We have got two Andrews on. Andrew Seidel will be joining us a little later. And I can't wait for that. And just wait, there's more. There is so much Andrew that and so much to talk about that we actually did a spillover episode into Serious Inquiries Only. And so this week's episode of my show, Serious Inquiries Only, is the continuance of our conversation. There's so much interesting stuff in all of it, and you got to listen to all of it. So check that out. And that's why the part of the reason why the episode is early is we wanted to make sure to release them at the same time. So that you'll have it all right away and it's in whatever order you want it and that kind of thing. But chronologically, this opening arguments conversation came first. So I'm glad you're listening to this now. And I will, of course, warn people on the other show to listen to this first. So I think that covers all the craziness of the episode. But in addition to Masterpiece, of course, we also had so much Yodel Mountain news. I mean, oh, man, that was one of the actually that was the main reason that I suggested we do this, Andrew, was I had seen already all the Yodel Mountain news and I knew we were going to have double the Andrew. And I was like, we're not going to be able to do all of that on one. It'd be like a 3 hour episode. So and it was.
Yeah, I am really, really excited about sharing both of those episodes with our listeners. This one and the Serious Inquiries Only. We spent over 2 hours with Andrew Seidel, and I kind of rode the roller coaster on this case a little bit. When it first came out, my take was, "Oh gosh, this is terrible." Then I read the opinion, and I was like, "Okay, well, maybe it's more narrow than it looks." And then I went back and read the opinion in depth in prepping for the show and all of the concurrences and the dissent. And I was like, well, narrow isn't quite the right, like there's a lot of bad stuff here. And then we brought on Andrew Seidel and he's got, he has a silver lining that I can't wait for us to get to. So I'm super excited about it.
It's a mess, but we're going to untangle it for everybody, myself included. I'm so glad.
Yep.
Again, we needed double your Andrew. So what else do we need to announce here? Anything you need to mention that we are leaving for next week, because there's so much this week.
we've had to push off a couple of things. We're doing an extended Yodel Mountain segment coming up next, and then next week there is an important development in Azar versus Garza, which is the abortion case involving undocumented minors in this country. We're on that. That's going to be next week. And then the big thing that I really, really wanted us to tackle in yodeling today, but it would just require us to record for 3 hours, is the leaked John Dowd memo to the Department of Justice in connection with the Mueller investigation. That is a goldmine. It has led to Rudy Giuliani's, you know, insane breakdown on that. We're going to go through it, and we're going to talk about the Dowd memo next week. So you're definitely not going to want to miss Tuesday's episode. Not that you ever want to miss an episode.
Yeah, nice sell job for Tuesday's episode. I think I'll definitely, I'll probably show up for that
good.
One. Yeah.
Tune in.
You sold me, Andrew. I don't know why I was thinking of not listening. No, that's awesome. I can't wait. But with how good that is, that just tells you how much we have in store for you today, that, you know, to have to push that off. So let's get to it.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
Nobody, so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse. I know you have to get up and ask a question, so important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
All right. We are yodeling. We are yodeling. It seems like that's all we're doing lately, but it's good yodeling. So much news. Let's start with Manafort.
Yeah. So couple of interesting developments coming out of our good buddy, Paul Manafort. The first is that we have, I'm going to upload a copy of the document, but the Department of Justice, the Mueller investigation in connection with Paul Manafort's pending criminal trial, has filed a motion to revoke his pretrial detention. He is currently under house arrest, and they want him to go to prison.
Yeah.
And I think they've got a really, really good chance of prevailing on this motion. So let's talk about it. That, by the way, the hearing on that is set for 1 week from this Friday, June 15th. So they've timed it to make sure that they miss next week's opening arguments episodes. Yeah. So, you know, we'll all be, while you're listening to next Friday's rapid response, this will be coming across the airwaves as to whether Manafort is going to jail. I don't want to do an Andrew was wrong, but I think he could be going to jail. So,
wow. Let's just do a reminder for everybody who Paul Manafort is. He was a coffee boy I think he might've worked for Trump getting coffee a couple times, and then he, you know, nobody knew him or anything like that. Oh no, wait, the revisionist history that's going in now.
Yeah. He was a low level campaign official who managed the Trump campaign for several months. This is, obviously, you know, we've described Trump defenders as sort of walking two quoque fallacies. That's pretty much all they have left. There's very little you can say about Manafort, right? Like the evidence as it's coming out is that this is just an exceptionally horrible human being. And you know, so it's harder and harder to kind of take up the defense. What happened here?
Okay, it can't get any worse.
Yeah,
but it got worse.
Yeah, it got worse. So here's the background, right? And we covered this on OA. On February 23rd, that was when the Mueller team issued two superseding indictments against both Manafort and Gates. And when they announced that Rick Gates was pleading guilty. So the superseding indictments managed to flip Gates. We have long said in consultation with prosecutors, listen to the show, it really looks like this is consistent. What the government is doing to Manafort is consistent with kind of putting the screws to him to try and get Manafort to flip. As we go through the government's motion here, it is clear how much they have been aided by Paul Gates, by Rick Gates's cooperation. So keep that in mind. On February 23rd, the government added a whole bunch of new charges, new criminal charges against Manafort and Gates. And some of the new charges against Manafort were the alleged violations of the Foreign Agents Registration Act, 22 U.S.C. 611. And those allegations concerned the fact that Manafort funneled money to senior European politicians who would then act as lobbyists on behalf of Ukraine. And the indictment alleges that Manafort sent them more than 2 million euros from secret overseas accounts. Those people, and this is the crucial part here to the story, those people who are referred to as the Habsburg Group, that, you know, again, I love the fact, just sort of parenthetically, the fact that all of the criminals in connection with Yodel Mountain are, you know, they're like, they have the secret notebook labeled, you know, Ukrainian documents. Like you call your shadowy cabal of Ukrainian lobbyists the Habsburg Group. Like, why not call it the Sunshine and Puppies Group? Like, this is my free non-legal
just
advice.
Call it like the chess club.
Right. Exactly. Pauly Manafort's Good Time Board Game Emporium. Yeah. Exactly. Manafort funneled funds from secret accounts to the Habsburg Group, and they then lobbied the U.S. government on behalf of Ukraine. That's all kinds of criminal behavior. Okay. Following the public disclosure of that superseding indictment, Manafort and somebody who is referred to as Person A. And again, I want to go back to our earlier reporting that I think has been confirmed on this when we were talking about the indictment of the lawyer from overseas who was with the big firm and who just, you know, had destroyed emails. Person A, as far as I can tell, seems to be Konstantin Kalimnik, right? So an individual with ties to Russian intelligence, a Russian intelligence.
I was
going to
say that's
operative.
Either one of the Bond characters, like not the main Bond villain, but someone Bond would have like met with, you know, or it's Russian intelligence in the real world. It's one of those two things.
Yeah. So keep in mind, this is who Manafort is using as his intermediary. Somebody who is a known Russian intelligence asset. And again, if that does not, if saying that sentence to your Trump supporting Uncle Frank, you know, causes him to go, well, you know, it's not like, then I don't like at that point that, right. That's treason, right? Like when your intermediary is a hostile foreign powers intelligence agent, you are either very, very stupid or very, very disloyal. And I do not believe that Paul Manafort is very, very stupid, although
right.
some of the facts of this may undercut that a little bit. Anyway.
Well, so, I don't want to preempt you, but I believe the current defense or the defense that it has been for a while is, oh, this was whatever. This was 10 years ago. You know, this was, you know, Trump had nothing to do with this. I think they've pretty much abandoned Manafort, haven't they?
Yeah, I think that's right. But the problem is that if you are thinking strategically about this, you need to, and you're a Trump supporter, you need to lay some kind of groundwork for Trump to pardon Manafort and otherwise convince Manafort not to roll over, because I think you have to surmise that, you know, Manafort knows where the bodies are buried, but we'll see.
Okay.
Right. So now Manafort talked to Person A, we believe is Konstantin Kalimnik, to then contact individuals who referred to as persons D1 and D2. Those are former employees of Manafort's organization. And the allegation is that they were contacted to give materially false testimony concerning the activities of the Habsburg Group. Neither person D1 nor D2 had any recent contact with Manafort or person A, but after the indictment was publicly disclosed, Manafort called person D1 on person D1's cellular phone. Person D1 then sought to avoid Manafort, so he hung up on him. So then the next day, Manafort sent person D1 a text message on an encrypted application, that's WhatsApp, stating, "This is Paul." 2 days later, he used WhatsApp to send person D1 a news article describing the allegations concerning the Habsburg Group. And then persons D1 and D2 both preserved those messages and turned them over to the government. And then the articles were sent, the description of the superseding indictment was sent, and then Manafort used WhatsApp to say, you know, as you know, the Habsburg Group never lobbied in the U.S., right? That's false, right? And so person D1 then went to the government, and this is directly from the motion, told the government that he understood Manafort's outreach to be an effort to suborn perjury, right? That is to induce him to make false testimony, because person D1 knew that the Habsburg Group worked in the United States, not just in Europe.
Question, yes. That's bad, right? Mm-hmm. Or is that good? Is that bad?
That's bad. Really, okay. Really bad.
Suborning.
And again, perjury, you know, this sort of illustrates what we've talked about on Yodel Mountain from the very beginning, right? Like, as the government gets evidence that, it's very difficult to do anything all by yourself and in a vacuum. And as the government gets evidence against the people that you have incidentally relied upon, right? These persons D1 and D2, it is very easy to read between the lines here, right? Like, they are longstanding, loyal Manafort employees, and all of a sudden their boss is facing the potential of the rest of his life in prison. And shockingly, that kind of worry is enough to make longstanding loyal employees go, "What, Paul? You need me to roll out how high?" You know, like, and that's clearly what happened, right? These people got the text messages, immediately went to the government and said, "Hey, Paul Manafort is trying to contact me, I did nothing, right? Please don't indict me." And that's what happened, right? So then in April, Manafort went back to Kilimnik and had him send yet another message that said, "My friend P is looking for ways to connect to you to pass you several messages. Can we arrange that?" There's a bit more kind of color and detail, but that's what the government alleges that Manafort has done. Used WhatsApp while under house arrest to try and secretly communicate with potential witnesses against him in the ongoing criminal investigation. And those allegations, if true, are criminal witness tampering. That's a crime under 18 U.S.C. 1512, which makes it a crime to knowingly and corruptly persuade or attempt to corruptly persuade another person with intent to influence the testimony of any person in an official proceeding, right? And
question, yes. Is that a federal crime?
Yeah, so a couple of things, right? First, it is in fact a federal crime. So yes, theoretically, Manafort could be pardoned for this offense. But there's actually a little more to think about beneath that. I'm not certain that Mueller is ever going to charge Manafort with witness tampering, right? If all they have is the evidence that's included in this motion, I'm not sure a prosecutor would bring that case under 18 U.S.C. 1512, but he doesn't have to. All he has to show is that under the terms of the pretrial release, that's governed by 18 U.S.C. 3148, if the government can file an application and show that they have probable cause to believe that the person on pretrial release, committed a crime, then he goes back to jail, right? Then they revoke that home detention that he has. And remember, probable cause is just, that's the same standard you need to get a search warrant. So it strikes me that this rises to the level of probable cause. I also think you're exactly correct that what Manafort's lawyers are going to do is to make a huge stink about how, you know, this is there's a thin case and this is overreach and you can't prove and all of that sort of stuff. We're going to see those arguments, but I don't think those arguments are going to keep Paul Manafort out of jail.
Wow. So, hey, kids, don't tamper with witnesses, I guess, is the...
Yeah, that's right. There's sort of a really interesting aspect about this in that, we've talked about data security on the show, right? And the way in which this search warrant was executed was really, really interesting, right? He used an encrypted app, WhatsApp. The potential witnesses turned over their WhatsApp texts to the FBI agents, who then went to Paul Manafort's computer's iCloud account and got the backup from iCloud. And so they never had to
crack anything.
Otherwise get.
Yeah.
Yeah. They didn't have to break the encryption. And so, you know, that's a really interesting development in terms of, you know, thinking about what's running on your computer, and you're like, "Oh, look, like I'm on the dark web. I have encrypted this." Well, you know, you might have encrypted it, but if Apple's iCloud is running, yeah. That encryption may not be doing you any good. So These allegations, remember that there are multiple pending cases against Manafort. These are going to the case that is being held, that is being presided over by Judge Amy Berman Jackson. And she has she's had sort of the no-nonsense approach with Paul Manafort so far.
So what are we looking for? Your prediction is see what Judge he will Jackson be does. In the slammer. I mean, he will be, wow.
I think... Yeah. Next 1 week from Friday, Manafort's going to jail.
Minor coffee boy, though. He didn't have anything to do. He
got right. But but it's not all bad news for Paul Manafort this week. You may recall, our listeners may recall that we discussed that in connection with the Manafort criminal investigation, that led to a motion by the various media organizations. So what happened was Manafort was challenging the indictment as being beyond Mueller's authority. And in connection with that argument, the government turned over a heavily redacted memo from Rod Rosenstein to Mueller, confirming that, yes, you have the authority to go after Paul Manafort. That's within the scope of your original appointment. And then that document was produced in this case and leaked out to the press. And leaked is the wrong word. It was, you know, publicly made available. And that led CNN, the AP, and Politico and other news organizations to file a broader motion to unseal everything in the Manafort investigation. And we talked about that. And yesterday, Manafort filed his response to the media's motion to unseal the records. I think that he has two really, really good arguments that at least relate to the documents in his case, right? So point number one that he makes is that Paul Manafort himself has not seen the unredacted documents, right? They have only been turned over and reviewed in camera by the judge, by Judge Jackson. And she denied his defense counsel's request to see those documents. So in connection with a criminal proceeding, it seems a little wrong to have a situation where the press and the criminal defendant get access to the documents at the same time. And I think that's a pretty good point.
Can you remind me what these documents the will larger, do? Like, what are we worried about either way with these documents becoming public?
So both, this is an area, this is, I think, the only area in which Mueller's investigation and Paul Manafort are on the same side, right? Mueller's team wants to keep the documents confidential because they don't want to accidentally reveal any of their strategy. And they don't want something to come up that's been redacted, right? Like, so for example, you know, the full text of the memo that Rosenstein sent is obviously super, super interesting. And the fact that 2/3 of the pages were blacked out gives us, you know, wide-ranging insight into how much Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein knows and, you know, when he knew it and all of that. So the government wants to keep them secret as a matter of strategy. Manafort wants to keep them secret because the documents pertaining to Paul Manafort are really, 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 really bad. And they're obviously going to publicly incriminate him. And that ties into his second set of arguments, which is supported by good case law. And I think he's going to win on this. Right. And so here's the argument. That is that the court has imposed a gag order on Paul Manafort in connection with this case. That order forbids him from, quote, making statements to the media or in public settings that pose a substantial likelihood of material prejudice to this case. Right. So be out there talking about it. And this court has further interpreted that order to prevent Manafort from, for instance, making public statements, maintaining his innocence, and reaffirming his commitment to defend himself against the, quote, untrue and piled up charges contained in the indictments against him. Right. So Manafort's argument is because the court has construed the gag order to prevent Manafort from going about saying, I'm innocent, these are all trumped up charges, this isn't, you know, this is a witch hunt, whatever.
Then the other side can kind of release stuff that says he's guilty. Is that what it is?
Right. To leak all the documents, right, is now that's going to provoke a firestorm of media coverage, and he's going to have to remain silent about it. And they conclude the argument with, Mr. Manafort has obeyed that court order, but his silence in the face of intensive
witness tampering, but, you know, he's obeyed that.
But some court orders he does abide by.
He had the decency to do his witness tampering in private. He didn't do it in public. You know, he's a good guy.
And so the argument is that will
that all seems right. But court. Like, why do we care? I mean, does it really matter? Or is this just a minor thing? Like, ultimately, either way, he still has all this stuff coming to him. You know, it's just when we find out, I guess. Oh, OK.
Correct. That's right. So, you know, so we talked about the various public interest and the arguments that were being made on behalf of the media entities when they first filed their motion. And I just want to say that with respect to the what we said at the time was that with respect to the closed cases, they probably have a pretty good argument. But with respect to the open cases, they probably don't. And this is a really good illustration of that. The reason why they don't and why I think that Manafort is going to prevail in his opposition to the motion is the risk of prejudicing the jury pool. Right? Mm-hmm. And that's a fair thing, right? It is you want even Paul Manafort to get an unbiased jury because the evidence of his guilt is so overwhelming that an unbiased jury is going to have no difficulty, in my view, concluding that that he broke the law. So, you know, let's not taint the jury pool by having them read all of the Mueller stuff in advance. That's pretty good art.
All right. Well, that's Manafort for now. So I can't wait for him to be behind bars. He's not a good guy, in my opinion. Humble. Yeah. I think that's the official OA position is not the best.
I think that's a fair way of putting it.
We want to hedge a little bit. Not the least corrupt guy. well, let's transition now over to Summer Zervos. Everybody, it's summertime and we've all got our Summer Zervoses. What's the update there?
Yeah, we first talked about Summer Zervos in OA 176, in which I called Donald Trump's personal lawyer, Mark Kasowitz, a lying sack of crap for the way in which he deliberately misrepresented the question on appeal, which is still on appeal to the New York Court of Appeals, their state Supreme Court. Our listeners may recall that This case is, in my view, entirely governed by the precedent from Clinton versus Jones, and the trial court judge agrees with that. So one of the things that happens, because there's no injunctive relief that's been issued, so the ruling where Trump lost at the appellate level stands, and so the case is going to go forward while this appeal to the state Supreme Court is pending. And so what happens when a case goes forward is that the first thing that a judge is going to do is set up a scheduling conference, right? And issue scheduling guidelines, right? And those say you have to do X by Y time, right? And so in a civil lawsuit, what you do is you set discovery deadlines. And those discovery deadlines help bring the case to an expeditious conclusion, right? You say, we know that you have to get all of your discovery out by a certain date. We know that it's all got to come in by a certain date, right? And here are the dates. The deadline to issue request for documents is July 13th of 2018. So little over 5 weeks from today. Is the deadline for the parties to request documents from each other. Again, this is a public case, so we will get to see what Summer Zervos' lawyers want from Donald Trump. And then the deadline for depositions is January 31st, 2019. So conveniently after the midterm elections, I suspect that Trump's lawyers are going to suggest that he just has, you know, too many conflicts between now and November 8th, 2018 to possibly sit for a deposition. He may not, you know, I mean, with Donald Trump, who knows what Donald Trump is going to do. But at this point in time, the case is on track to get discovery. And as we pointed out, the yodel implications of that are directly related to the yodeling implications from Clinton versus Jones, right? That whenever you have the president under oath and turning documents, turning over documents is, again, you turn those over, you answer your interrogatories, you have to sign a verification page that, again, is under oath. So even though it's not in court testimony, this is still testimony in a judicial proceeding, and you can perjure yourself. And so, you know, this is a real danger for Donald Trump going forward. So in summary, I was right. Mark Kasowitz is still a lying sack of crap, and we're going to get discovery in the Summers Ervos litigation.
I really wonder, I want to know if anyone else before us has used the term yodel implications. like a yodeling, you know, group that was like, oh, what are the yodel implications of this here mountain that we're, or something. I don't know. Was there ever an organic usage of that? I don't know.
I like to think that we've added something new to the lexicon, so.
I love it. All right. Well, that's the Yodel Mountain update. And now we've got to get over to our fantastic regular now guest, who feels like an honorary third host, Andrew Seidel, to talk about Masterpiece Cake Shop. Here we go. All right, Andrew and Andrew, we're doubling our in normal Andrew content. That is the doctor recommended Andrew content is based on a one Andrew calorie diet. No, I can't go any further with that. How's it going, Andrew Seidel?
I'm well. Thanks for having me on again, guys. It's only been a month since I've been on. We're making it a regular thing.
Yeah, we've got to have you on under better circumstances.
Well, last time it was a big win for us. So, you know.
That's true. I went back and I listened to Andrew Torres and I first talked about this on here like 8 months ago. And I listened to that and then I went back and checked out when Andrew Seidel was on to talk about this. That was 5 months ago, but I am pleased. Well, not pleased. I do have to report as I listened and we got to the prediction section. Drum roll. Andrew Seidel, I think you nailed it. Now, you didn't nail the count, but I think you said 5-4 in this direction that it went. But let's talk about the masterpiece, of course, Cake Shop case. And the decision, the way it went, and you can take a very bad victory lap. It's not a happy victory lap. It's a very sad.
Yeah,
victory
it's a
lap.
Sad head down victory lap.
This is the worst possible Andrew was right segment. Right? It is. It's the wrong Andrew being right. He's right for the wrong reasons. I mean, it's just this is. I want to retire the segment. I want to quit the show.
So. If you drew up a matrix of like all the different combinations of Andrews being right and wrong and for which reasons, it really was like the lowest possible. You know, bottom right corner that you were just praying wasn't going to be the one.
Yeah, I didn't want to be. I really wanted to be wrong. And then I was going to be happy I was wrong. But I mean, the hostility, the idea that this decision was somehow hostile to the bakery was an easy out for the court to avoid deciding two not hard questions, but questions that it thought was hard, apparently.
So, okay.
So when I saw 7-2 as news,
yeah,
I instantly thought, okay, 7-2, there's no way. Unless we are in literally the worst of all timelines, there's no way the establishment part went 7-2 the other way. But I hope I'm not wrong on that. What happened?
Well, so, I mean, I think, remember, there's two basic questions in the case. There's, does the bakery have a free speech right to avoid making this cake? Does the bakery have a free religious free exercise right to reject this gay couple, not serve them? And the court avoided both of those questions, and instead, on the basis of basically a guy who was trolling other bakeries and asking them to bake cakes with a Bible verse, on the basis of decisions against that guy, and on the basis of a few really, really modest, really like statements that had to do with the tone of the commissioners who were investigating this, the Supreme Court said, you know what? You were hostile to the bakery's religion. So they said that the consideration of this case was inconsistent with the state's obligation of religious neutrality because they showed this religious hostility. There was religious hostility on the part of the state itself, which that is, in my mind, completely manufactured here. There was no hostility. The court really, really looked to find hostility, and in the end had to manufacture it.
Yeah, and God, I want to jump in with two things here. Right? So the first premise that's true, which is the basis for the Andrew Seidel was right, is that the Supreme Court entirely punted on the compelled speech First Amendment question, right? And that is really the major issue that is sort of being debated, you know, at the lay level, right, on the streets, right? Like, are you forcing somebody to speak when, you know, you're a gay couple and you ask a bake shop to bake a cake celebrating your wedding? However, what I find, and so in that sense, right, this ruling has been characterized as narrow. And I want to say a couple of things on that, because I think even Trump kind of rather stupidly got on the, like, well, how can you call a 7-2 decision narrow?
No, I think it was Trump Jr. I saw that.
Yeah,
he was like, 7-2, I don't call that narrow. Right. Am I right, guys? Like,
So
who's going to tell him?
Yeah, Andrew doesn't need to hear this, but and I don't even think our listeners need to hear this. When lawyers say that a decision is narrow, we mean that it is confined.
But I do, you're saying?
Yeah. No. You left me out.
You're right. Like, this is just for Thomas.
Right now.
Thomas and Donald Trump Jr., the only two people.
Yeah. Well, I saw Britt Hume say something similar, and I saw Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz, who really knows better,
Ted Cruz knows better and is lying, right? Like, I mean, but we know that, right? So when lawyers say that this decision is narrow, what we mean is confined to the facts of the case and not establishing a broad general principle, right? And that's true in one sense, right? It's true in the sense that the Supreme Court did not rule on the compelled speech question, which would have wide-ranging implications for the Arlene's Flowers case. I mean, would have wide-ranging implications for lots of other cases.
I mean, another way I think of saying what you're saying here is that the Supreme Court it avoided the big questions and gave the bakery a win on something that it was not seeking a win on, right? So it took this idea of hostility towards the bakery's religion and ran with it, and nobody wanted that. I mean, it was barely argued. I think it wasn't even almost an afterthought if you look at the briefing. It was barely in any, it was certainly not fully briefed. And instead the Supreme Court took it and ran with it. And the previous case that dealt with hostility towards religion was Lukumi Babalu I versus City of Hialeah, and this was a Santeria church. And the bar for the government showing hostility towards religion was incredibly high. It was almost unattainable. And Lukumi was the central case that defined what is hostility towards religion. And if you know the facts of that case, there absolutely was hostility. I mean,
that case, we call it the City of Hialeah case here on OA, even though the Supreme Court.
Lukumi is more fun to say.
I know. That's why I've always called it City of Hialeah.
Another one of the more fun disagreements between Andrews.
You can tell the difference between written legal commentators and audio legal commentators. I have always called it the City of Hialeah case because I do not want to have to say Church of the Lukumi Babalu Aye. But absolutely right. So OA listeners know that's the case in which the city council said we can't bring in those Santeria church, you know, into our city, and let's pass this ordinance to make sure they can't, you know, practice Santeria within our city. I mean, it is literally the paradigmatic case of religious discrimination. What I find really, really troubling about Masterpiece Cake Shop is, you know, notwithstanding the narrowness of remanding on the factual question regarding religious hostility. And Andrew, yeah, you know, you and I are going to break that down in a minute. I mean, it's a farce what they found.
And I mean, they didn't remand either, which I think is part of the strangeness of the decision as well.
Yeah. No. That good correction. Yeah. No. No. Finding reversing on the basis of the transcript at the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. I want us to talk about that. But I also want to talk about what this case does to Scalia's rule from Employment Division versus Smith, right? That's the that has been free exercise law.
So you brought this
law.
Up in my review, yeah. You brought this up a lot as like, here's, we can quote Scalia's own words at the new Scalia's son, Gorsuch, and his mini-me. We could quote his words at him, and that'll be the way to fight off this argument. Is that what you're referring
yeah,
to?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Look, free exercise jurisprudence in the U.S. has been dead since 1990, right? It because Antonin Scalia ruled that so long as you have a neutrally applicable law that is not overtly hostile to religion, the fact that it incidentally burdens the free exercise of religion is not sufficient to justify either a claim for a religious exemption or, you know, striking down the law as violative of the First Amendment's free exercise clause. Right. That was the Peyote case. That was the genesis for RFRA and for legislative solutions to it. But the Supreme Court has consistently read that case as applying to everyone's religious rights. And basically what that says is that at the Supreme Court level, we will apply the rational basis test when we look to laws that members of religious groups claim violate their right to practice religion. As Andrew well knows, when you apply the rational basis test, that means that the Supreme, right, that is the fogged mirror test. That means mm-hmm. that so long as you don't have a situation like City of Hialeah, so long as you don't have overwhelming evidence that the law has an improper purpose, then it's going to be justified, right? All you have to do is find a rational basis. And so the rational basis in Employment Division versus Smith was just the government wants people not to smoke peyote, and the fact that that seems disproportionately to fall on a certain, religious minority. Well, you know, too bad, you don't get to override the general law. So the fact that we are evaluating the free exercise claims of Christians in the majority is in my view, I mean, just a radical reopening of the doctrine. And some of the language, right, particularly in the Gorsuch concurrence is shocking, frightening, terrifying with respect to the way some of the Supreme Court justices have now, you know, really stood, in my view, the purpose of the First Amendment on its head, right? Like if protecting individual rights is meant to mean anything, it is meant to protect minority religions against, you know, the free exercise clause is meant to protect minority religions against legislative invasion by the government. And now we have a situation where if you put these two cases together, minority religions get no protection, but the religion that is the overwhelming majority of the United States and specifically the virulent right wing conservative Protestant Christianity that is the entirety of Donald Trump's base is now carved out for special protection in the law, and that's I lack words to explain how. What a monumental injustice that is. And it would be an injustice if this were, regardless of the merits, right? Like to take a majoritarian position and say that's what the First Amendment is meant to protect is just terrifying.
Can we talk about the mechanics of what happened? Because I'm a little confused how this even works. So basically the person that, and I tweeted, because Trump said, great news for Baker. And he just said for Baker with a capital B. Right. And I'm pretty Jim sure Baker. He thinks that, yeah, it's actually, he thinks the guy's name is actually Christian Baker. Like, I think, yeah. Prove me wrong, everybody. Yeah. Prove me wrong. He thinks it's Christian Baker. Anyway, okay, so what happens is Christian Baker discriminates, obviously, and Andrew Seidel, as you've pointed out many times, I've quoted you on this a lot, It wasn't, oh, we want a design of, and this is where we got the famous Andrew Torres quote of doing in the butt is awesome. It's not like that's what happened. They requested that. They just came in the place. The guy, realized he was speaking to a gay couple and turned them down and told them to leave, essentially. So that happens. And then we go through a series of challenges, right? And it seemed like the gay couple had been successful on the last one before the Supreme Court, right?
They'd been successful all the way through.
Yeah.
All the way through. And then, so how does this work where by some technicality, they didn't decide on any of the issues, but they said, because of some weird thing where somebody on a commission was mean to somebody, therefore it's okay to discriminate against gay people? I don't get it.
Yeah, I mean,
what is it?
I think,
what happened?
I think it's hard to understand. I think it was the Baker, or no, excuse me, it was the couple's attorney, I think, had the best sort of metaphor for this. And basically the way he described it was, he said, you know, for the couple, it's over. We don't have anything left that we can do. And that's accurate. And he framed it as basically the Supreme Court gave the bakery a get out of jail free card. That's essentially what they did.
Yeah.
And it's this, you,
yeah, it's like, okay, you get one free discrimination. That's what,
I mean,
how
it,
we want,
I think,
the country to work.
That's not a bad way to understand it, unfortunately. It's terrible, but that, I think that's not that bad. That wow, frames it well, I think.
So I thought I might have been joking, but I wasn't. Yeah. That happens often on the show when we're talking about the religious right. Okay, go ahead.
Well, so here's what the court says, and you will notice that there are no citations for any of these propositions, right? This is at the top of page 12 of the slip opinion, which we're going to link in the show notes. So after sort of articulating the dispute, right, sincerely held religious beliefs versus fundamental right to equality, and in particular, equality guaranteed by the Colorado statute that's applicable here. And then the court says, there were, to be sure, responses to these arguments, that is, the religious freedom arguments, that the state could make when it contended for a different result in seeking the enforcement of its generally applicable state regulations for businesses that serve the public. And any decision in favor of the baker would have to be sufficiently constrained, lest all purveyors of goods and services who object to gay marriages for moral and religious reasons, in effect, be allowed to put up signs saying no goods or services will be sold if they will be right, used for gay marriages, something that would impose a serious stigma on gay persons. But nonetheless, Phillips was entitled to the neutral and respectful consideration of his claims in all the circumstances of the case. That sentence, that you have a First Amendment right to the neutral and respectful consideration of your claims in all the circumstances of the case, A, I don't know what that means, and B, it is entirely invented out of whole cloth. Right? And then the next sentence is, the neutral and respectful consideration to which Phillips, that's Christian Baker, was entitled, yeah, was compromised here, right? And we can get into the ridiculous basis on which it was compromised. But again, I want to throw it to Andrew. I certainly do not know of any constitutional law, case adjudicating the First Amendment that says everybody gets a neutral, let's use the exact words, neutral and respectful consideration of your religious beliefs. Where in the hell does that come from?
So, I mean, this is part of the reason I think your concern with Smith and reopening this doctrine might be a little bit overblown right now. What Kennedy did, he pulled random concepts, as you said, with no support from due process, from free speech, from free exercise, and mashed them all together into this idea that, hey, you know what? Basically, the commission was mean to the bakery. Right. They disrespected the bakery's religion. It was an issue of tone. And actually, this is kind of crazy, but I actually liked the way that Sarah Huckabee Sanders said it in her briefing the day after the case.
Holy.
She said,
Brian, pull that quote.
Yeah. Now let's start a blackmail file on Andrew Seidel as well.
End his career. No, I'm just kidding.
She said that the Supreme Court rightly concluded that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission failed to show tolerance and respect for the bakery's religious beliefs. That is not a thing. That's not a legal test. That's not in the Constitution.
Yeah.
I mean, and to quote Kennedy said, this sentiment is inappropriate. And that's what this decision was about. It was manufactured hostility.
But how can they just do that? I don't get it.
Because they're the Supreme
Court.
This
is a separate issue. This is like one minor thing that you would, as you were ruling on the actual issues, you'd be like, side note, write a letter of complaint to this commission because they're kind of douchey when they evaluate. It's a nothing issue.
Let me jump in on that, right? Like it's why I'm glad we began with the City of Hialeah case. You're reacting emotionally, Thomas. But I want to be clear.
Sorry, I've just that's another ground for dismissing the case.
But I want to point out you're not being hyperbolic, right? Like Prior to now, it has always been, again, my understanding, every case I've ever read that challenges a statute on discrimination grounds, right, be it First or 14th Amendment grounds, free exercise or due process, right? When somebody goes into court and says, you know, this lawmaker who passed this law said this bad thing about me or my business or my industry or a group of people, the Supreme Court has always looked to the City of Hialeah case and said, you know what, we have to figure out before we start delving into the motivations of the legislature, right? It has to rise to this threshold, right? It has to rise to the level of the people who passed the law went on the record and said, I hate this religion and we're passing this law and it doesn't matter what it says. We're only passing this law to keep this Santeria church out of our city. And yes, you know, right, we're going to say it's about, you know, cleanliness in animal handling, but we're going to totally let everybody but Santeria practitioners do it, right? Like, that's the standard. And so in other words, right, the court has said essentially, you don't get to be a snowflake about this, right? Like, if the legislature's mean to you, you know, too bad. You don't have a constitutional right for the legislature not to be mean to you.
It's not even that, it's the commission, right? Write the law?
No, they were, and it,
no, they didn't even, oh my God.
But I mean, and so that's a big part of it. And I think what the Lukumi bar was nearly unattainable,
right?
And now it's been lowered to basically ankle level. I mean, this sentiment is inappropriate,
but I bet it will not, right? Like, we've talked to the reason we talk about City of Hialeah is, you know, in connection with all of the
we're gonna find out.
I love that
fast.
You guys still have separate names for it,
right?
And but now that there's a Lukumi bar, I'm actually leaning toward Andrew Seidel's naming.
I like Lukumi bar. Sounds like a place you go to get tropical drinks, and they've got little umbrellas in it.
You forgot about one thing: the Lukumi bar.
I could hang out at the Lukumi bar and have a couple of drinks. but okay, right. So let's hope there's not going to be going to be an Andrew was right on this one, because, right, we have been dismissive on this show of the numerous pending appellate cases that have attached Donald Trump's tweets, Donald Trump's memoranda, and said, look, like, that's not enough to clear the Lukumi bar. So, I think we're going to get that test, right?
We're going to find out within a month is my guess. And we're going to find out more broadly shortly thereafter, because I'll tell you right now, we had a strategy meeting, the Freedom From Religion Foundation, today.
Right.
How can we use this now incredibly low Lukumi bar to our advantage? I mean, it's really difficult. Kennedy said this sentiment is inappropriate. And that is what the decision was based on. It's about tone. Tone. It's about propriety.
Stars,
my fragile religious constitution cannot bear to hear the
someone
truth.
Someone was wearing a hat that said hoof arted. And so that was inappropriate. And therefore, we're ruling. Like, how does that affect?
So again,
the ruling. I don't even get it.
Let's read it directly from the opinion, because again, I want to point out, Thomas, you are not being hyperbolic, right?
I'm trying to be, and I can't succeed, you cannot be hyperbolic.
Right? So here's what the commissioner said. This is page 16 of the opinion. Quote: I would also like to reiterate what we said in the hearing or the last meeting. Freedom of religion and religion has been used to justify all kinds of discrimination throughout history. That's a fact.
True.
Whether it be slavery, that's a fact. Whether it be the Holocaust, that's a fact. Whether it be, I mean, we, we can list hundreds of situations where freedom of religion has been used to justify discrimination. Again, all factual statements. And to me, it is one of the most despicable pieces of rhetoric that people can use to use their religion to hurt others. That's it. That well, is what the oh, Supreme that's Court what decided.
Well, hang on. Pause for a second. Yes. Pause for a second, too, because her next sentence Kennedy did not include. And her next sentence was, so that's just my personal view, which I think is kind of important. Oh my God. And it's also, you have to remember the context. This was Commissioner Rice. This was in 2014. The commission had already written its order in the case. Okay? It was only discussing a motion to deny staying that final order. So the final order was drafted. The bakery had responded to the final order. The notice of appeal was already filed with the appeals court, whose decision the Supreme Court was eventually going to review. And that notice of appeal was given to the commission. So they'd, and actually they pointed out earlier in this exact exchange, another commissioner said, we've already rejected the bakery's arguments three separate times. We really don't need to stay the decision. So, I mean, it had no bearing on the actual decision of the commission. It did not affect their administration of justice in any way.
And again, I want to go back to the test.
So how was this 7-2 right, though?
Well, I've got a supposition on that, but I want to go back to again the test that Kennedy sets out. Right? He says,
"Well, I don't think you can call it a test." Well, I'm not kidding.
No, you're right. But
I don't think you're doing what every good lawyer should do, Andrew, and you're trying to pull the principles and how do we move forward from this, and is there a test? I genuinely do not think that exists in this case. I think if
I were putting a parenthetical together, I would say that what this case stands for is that the First Amendment's free exercise clause means that individuals are entitled to, quote, neutral and respectful consideration, end quote, of their religious beliefs, right? So assume that that's the rule, right? And I'm with you, right? If that's the rule, how is the paragraph that we just quoted, how is that not
yes.
neutral and respectful consideration, right? And again, I want to point out, right, I get that it's negative, right? But the context in which the commission was saying that negative thing about this person's religious beliefs was in response to that person saying, because of my religious beliefs, I want to discriminate against gay people, right? Like, this is not just in the abstract, like, oh, the Phillips showed up in court and he's a Christian and you know how those people are, right? This is the person claimed, I am using my Christianity to discriminate against people. And then the commission said, we should consider that religion and religious beliefs are sometimes used to discriminate against people, right? Like that even if it weren't true as a sociological fact, it is stipulated on the record in this case, right? Like I don't understand. I mean, does neutral and respectful consideration mean that when somebody is claiming the right to be a bigot for religious reasons, we have to pretend that they're not? I mean, I don't get
right.
I honestly don't understand.
I think that's an excellent point, and it's something that I don't think can be explained away by anybody, really. I mean, there's another side to it too, is you can actually read that quote, and who knows, because all they're going from is a transcript, and they didn't actually, this issue was not briefed. Literally, the commission and the gay couple addressed hostility towards his religion, towards the baker's religion, in one footnote. That's it. And I went back and I counted because I was so blown away that they did this. And in the hostility
you
was not
so
argued.
Blown away by your own prediction, but keep going.
I did not want it to happen. 11 paragraphs.
Andrew
okay?
Torres is a little bitter that he was.
Yeah.
11 paragraphs dealing with hostility in 345 pages of briefing from the principal parties and the United States. That's it. That's how little this issue mattered. And the flip side of it, Andrew, I think you're absolutely right. You know, this people saying that discrimination is despicable, even if it's based on religion, is not crazy. I mean, in Trinity Lutheran, the Supreme Court itself called discrimination against the church odious. You know, yep. I mean, invidious discrimination is a term that we hear that the Supreme Court invented. It's there all the time. Justice right. Thomas, in a 1995 decision on segregation, he was dissenting. He said that civil rights laws were designed to end despicable discrimination. He said the despicable system of segregation that existed until 1954. I mean, that's the same word. And they do this all the time. And all of a sudden, this is why it was a cowardly punt, or yeah. we're all framing this yeah. as a cowardly punt.
I agree. I want to read. I don't want to pass on. And this is another area where I look, I don't like to try and get inside someone's head, but I cannot read this passage as anything other than dishonest. And if you want to give me a counter hypothesis, I'd love to hear it because
yeah, I have two extremes of ideas for what this is about.
So the analysis that comes next, right? So here's okay. what Kennedy says after having quoted that one paragraph from the transcript, which, as you point out, is out of context. Then Kennedy says, to describe a man's faith as, quote, one of the most despicable pieces of rhetoric that people can use, end of quote, is to disparage his religion in at least two distinct ways, by describing it as despicable and also by characterizing it as merely rhetorical, something insubstantial and even insincere. The commissioner even went so far as to compare Phillips' invocation of his sincerely held religious beliefs to defenses of slavery and the Holocaust. This sentiment is inappropriate for a commission charged with the solemn responsibility of fair and neutral enforcement of Colorado's yeah. anti-discrimination law, a law that protects discrimination on the basis of religion as well as sexual orientation. Now, I don't...
sentiment is inappropriate.
All of our... you can count all of our fundamentalist Christian listeners on zero hands, but there is no... That is either a fundamental failure of reading comprehension or profound dishonesty. Right? I mean, like, that's not what the transcript says.
That's why I continue to call this manufactured. And you can actually read the transcript the exact opposite way. And I think my guess is, at some point, we're going to hear from Commissioner Rice. I suspect that this is a religious individual who does not want her religion being used
yeah.
to discriminate against other. That is the way that I read it when that's how I read an oral argument.
Yeah. I totally agree. I mean, because right. I mean, you know, the three of us are atheists, but like I serve on, you know, a number of boards and charitable foundations with liberal Christians with whom I share a great many common causes. Right. And this is exactly the kind of rhetoric that you see in those situations. Right. We should use our faith for charitable causes to help people, to build people up, and that's a noble sentiment. But yeah, that's exactly the way in which I read the commission statements. To say that they were comparing his religious belief to justification of the Holocaust is just you can't take that out of what was said. So Andrew, I have my theory. I suspect we are going to overlap substantially here, but. Why don't you tell me yours as to how this came to be a 7-2 decision?
Well, I mean, I guess I have two extreme. I have two ends of a spectrum of how we got this decision. The first is that the Supreme Court has a problem when it comes to religion. They're terrified of offending. I think you can read this decision in that way. I think the manufactured hostility is an attempt. It very clearly looks like an attempt to avoid deciding the big issues. And we've seen this in the past in Supreme Court decisions. In the 2005, when they decided Van Orden and McCreary County on the same day and said one Ten Commandments monument can come up or can stay up, one has to come down. I think it's fair to say that given Kennedy's lack of principles in this case, pulling from due process, pulling from free speech, pulling from free exercising, and cobbling together this nonsense about hurting a religious person's feelings, that you can just say the Supreme Court does not know what it's doing when it comes to religion, and it's terrified of offending the majority. I think that's a fair reading of the case. If you think and you still have faith in the law and in the courts and are not a complete cynic, you can go the complete opposite route, which is that Kennedy and Kagan are playing a game of chess and Trump's travel ban is about to go down hard. And there's a couple really good articles about that that have me thinking. Politico magazine had a really good one about it. Is that where your head was at on this? Or
that is not where my head was at. My head is, I guess, more on the cynical side. I lost on this, right? Andrew was wrong. I thought this was going to be 5-4 the other way, based on Anthony Kennedy's long-standing, vigorous, often, you know, to the left of much of the rest of the court's, you know, liberal wing, certainly to the left of Stephen Breyer on LGBTQ issues, and my reading on this is that Breyer and Kagan looked at the scenario, realized when they, and in conference, right, as this is going back and forth, and Gorsuch's hand goes up and he says, well, I'd like to write this opinion. We got, you know, looked at it and said, boy, if we've lost Kennedy, and so how do we contain the damage here? And so if we sign on to a, quote, narrower opinion, and empower Kennedy to write it, are we better off than Kennedy joining in a Gorsuch sure. opinion?
I think that's legit. And that where would you put that on my spectrum? Maybe like towards the middle?
Yeah, you know, a different axis. I liked your, you know, three-dimensional chess of this is the long game to lower the Lukumi bar. You've got a good track record on this show, so if that turns out to be the case, you know, then I mean, to me, that's the hopeful message out of this, right?
Maybe we should end on the hopeful message. Yeah.
because that gives us something that we can take away from it. Because if you read this on its face, right, it is a one-way right. It is a right for religious people to have neutral and respectful consideration of their beliefs, even when they're being marshaled in support of discrimination. And I don't see what the equal but opposite right to somebody who has no religious beliefs is. You know, I can speak
to that a little bit.
Take advantage of it. Great, great. I'd love to hear it.
So, I mean, I'll say two more things before we're done. So, one, we often hear a lot from government officials. A good example is when a non-religious person wants to go in and give an invocation before a government body. We often see, first of all, disparate treatment because they are non-religious. And second of all, we see an attack on them and their godlessness or godlessness in general. A lot of the ceremonial deism laws were passed with language attacking atheists and godlessness and godless communists. So there actually is a little bit of, if you believe that this Lukumi bar now has been lowered and that this is the new test and that it is going to be applied by courts uniformly, then actually there is some really interesting ripe fruit that the non-religious community, the secular legal community can start plucking right away. We're actually looking at filing some supplemental authority in a couple of our cases in the next couple of weeks, so I can keep you updated on that. So that's one way. Now, the second possibility, the three-dimensional chess here is Kennedy was lowering the standard for what can be considered when you're showing animus against a religion on purpose. And doing that in this case where he could get conservative votes so that later when they issue the travel ban decision in, you know, sometime in the next 3 weeks, they have Trump on record saying much worse things than the commission here said and are able to bring all of that in now and say, hey, look, you know, we just said the commission, whose decision they weren't even supposed to be reviewing. Procedurally, they were supposed to be reviewing the Colorado Supreme Court's, or excuse me, appeals court decision. And so they actually shouldn't have even been looking at what the commission said. They should have been looking for that invidious hostility in the Colorado Court of Appeals decision, which is impossible to find there. So they had to go outside of it. So what this does is, if you want the positive outcome, is open up the ability of the court to decide against Trump in the travel ban case. And right after this decision came down, they scheduled the Florist case, which is a harder case to make, I think, the free speech argument for conference on Thursday. Which means that they are going to decide whether or not to accept that case. So the really positive outlook, if you really want to take away and you're like, you need a positive message this week after this case, is this means that Trump's travel ban is going down, that they're going to accept cert on the Florist case, and then they're going to be able to have the easier decision against the Florist on the speech question and decide the big question in our favor as well. That would be the most hopeful message that you could possibly glean from the events of this week. But
I'm not that hopeful of a person.
Yeah. That sounds like a fairy tale land. This is why I love having you on the
show. It's a stretch. I will be the first to admit it.
All right. Well, Andrews, this is a cool thing we're going to do because there's so much more to talk about on this. And of course, we have so much Trump crap to talk about. So the way we're going to kind of make some extra time and still get to have plenty of Andrew on Andrew action going on, just talking about gay cakes, is we're going to continue the discussion over on Serious Inquiries Only. We're going to do a bit of a crossover. There's a lot more to talk about. And also, I want to ask a few questions kind of from more of the secular community angle as well, which is more appropriate for that show. So I'm excited because there's so much more to talk about. When you got two genius Andrews on the line, pretty much never ends. So thanks so much, Andrew Seidel, for popping on here and helping break that down. And wow, I'm pretty flustered and just bewildered about it. But, at least you've explained some theories.
Yeah, I mean, it was not a good week. But it could have been a lot worse. It could have been a lot worse. It could have been a whole lot worse.
Yeah, that's true.
They didn't get the win they wanted.
I kind of feel like that's the epitaph for the entire country under the Trump administration. I could imagine that this could be worse.
You're going to love this. Believe me, this is the greatest part of the program.
It's cool. Just cool. Nice.
Thank you.
All right, and it is time to thank our Hall of Fame patrons, our all-time greats, over at patreon.com/law. I hope you enjoyed 12 Angry Men. We really enjoyed making it for you. That was a fun one. And as always, the hits will continue. But Andrew, let's start with our first group of Hall of Famers.
Yeah, thank you to Heather Loveridge, longstanding Hall of Fame patron. Thanks to our show is basically Dr. Drew and Adam Carolla, but with law stuff.
That's funny thing is I used to be an Adam Carolla fan before he just turned into a conservative, and he actually started this show too. He started a show with the guy who defended with a famous lawyer. He actually predates the show. I didn't steal that idea from that, but he does have that very show. I just thought I'd point it out. But listen to ours; it's better.
Yeah, ours is definitely better. All right, thanks to Mike the Intactivist, to Elizabeth Warren is trying to starve my friends via EBHTA. To don't drown in your data like the Terminator, go to alloyit.com. Continue to read that for as long as you're a patron. Thanks to This Week in News with Kevin and Benedict, to Derek Jeter's Taco Hole, to Last Chance to See by Douglas Adams is very underrated. It is indeed. If you like animals, you should read that book. To The One Thing You Cannot Afford to Have is a Sense of Proportion, to My Grammar is Not That Bad, Don't Slow Down, to Anonymous, to WordOrigins.org. Let's run it up the flagpole and see if the cat licks it up. Oh, great reference. To Andrew Torres.
He mixed his metaphors there, but yeah, that's great.
Right. No, it was great. It was, I think, intentional.
On purpose. Yeah, yeah.
To P. Andrew Torres, wear a miniskirt on Casual Collusion Fridays. Sure, yeah, why not? To Beth can't think of anything particularly clever right now. To either Andrew or Thomas died at the end of Infinity War. To But Lady, I'm flying a spaceship. Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense. Join your labor union and oppose employee declawing and ear talking. To Hey Baby, I'm Optimus Prime. #Hashtag Don't Fire Brian. Trump Run, we'll Undone, Once Lump Sum Funds to Dumb Tongue Sea Sun. To C6 Sarah. Sammy, Roger, but the sign said all you could eat Metcalf, the Frying Dutchman, Rhonda the Dork, Reagan Klein, our first patron, Danny Rosari, adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking, to Paula Nancy Millstone Jennings, the Wayward Willis Podcast, Philip Stromberg, Buttercup's Legal Services, actual legal advice from an actual cat, Tricicular Manslaughter, CampQuest.org, 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 Time is an Illusion, Lunchtime Doubly So, Lamb the First Purge, Impeachment in 25 Weeks, Had the Cold War, Now the Cold Civil War, to Veni, Vidi, Pro Hoc Vici. That's fantastic. That's so good. To Picklesby, Wigglesby, Jigglesby, Gigglesby, Flipperty, Flapperty, Yay. To Demonic Possession is 9/10 of the Law. And finally, to a string of unpronounceable characters.
Thanks to As Once Did Rome, Yuan, and Britain, So Too Shall the United States. Mitch McConnell is the Pale Man. Soul, Aaron Rabies is a filthy colonialist and can't even write a sandworm. Good philosophers in space splash damage there. I like it. Kevin Graham, Kim Jong Un. Kim Jong Un mas cerveza, por favor. best segment of the show. James Cole voted most likely to donate to a podcast. James English, that was a really prescient yearbook. James English, Jim Grove, Dave rooting for the sinkhole Nichols. President Thomas Smith will pardon the right people within two tries. That feels like what Trump's doing right now. Ian and Ollie, Yusuke Irameshi, Baltimore, that's like being hit in the head with a crowbar once a day. Okay, what do we need to do to get Andrew to get a tramp stamp? I feel like we have it's even money on getting Andrew a tramp stamp or a better computer to have better sound quality.
Yeah, right.
Even money right now. Eli Bosnick, Sam Dinow, Here Comes Diggins. The OA theme song sounds better. 1.5x. Soggy Pants, Benjamin Crom, Brian Upshaw's Last Chance for Profit Prison. Matt is moving back to Switzerland. No more Tuesday chats about opening arguments. Vote yes for Oklahoma SQ788 medical marijuana on June 28th. All right, sure. 4 of 20 tertiary adjunct of Unimatrix 69. Alec Emke, Adam Lenda, Aaron Grady, Aaron Golliver, Rob Schreck, Sakashite Fukasumi, the slum dude millionaire, Jordan Galash, Anthony Kennedy's ambiguous writing pen, narrowly construed edition. Nice. Dave, inexperienced knifeman, inexperienced woodsman, basically zombie. there might be more to that. It got cut off, but it might be something else. Mitchell, Liz is raising money for kids with cancer. Check profile link. Stop breaking the law, asshole. 50 per month, and Aaron will read any name. Chewittle Elijah Four. Oh, man, I got hit by that. I'll have to tell Aaron. Aaron can't read Patreon names on Philosophers in Space. It's the funniest thing we do because he just can't do it. It's hilarious. Prostetnik, Vogon, Jelts, Intergalactic Poet, Kim Kardashian's Glamorous Private Privet. Sorry, I started laughing. Glamorous Private Prisons. Conrad Michaels, our top patron. Oh, man. Thank you, folks, so much. It is so funny, and it's great to have so many names, and thanks for supporting the show. Wow. All right, it's TTTBE time.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, well, as usual, when we have an esteemed guest like Andrew Seidel, we want to, you know, see how he does on the bar exam. So we're going to do TTTBE, and Andrew Seidel, as always, for the sanctity of the game, don't help me. Let me struggle and get the wrong answer first, and then you can give me the right answer after that. So let's hear it.
All right, this is a perfect question to have Andrew Seidel on as our guest. It just came up next in order, so a fortuitous alignment of the planets. Here we go. A grantor executed an instrument in the proper form of a warranty deed purporting to convey a tract of land to his church. The granting clause of the instrument ran to the church, quote, and its successors forever, so long as the premises are used for church purposes, end quote. The church took possession of the land and used it as a site of worship for many years. Subsequently, the church decided to relocate and entered into a valid written contract to sell the land to a buyer for a substantial price. The buyer wanted to use the land as a site for business activities and objected to the church's title. The contract contained no provision relating to the quality of the title the church was bound to convey. There is no applicable statute. When the buyer refused to close, the church sued the buyer for specific performance and properly joined the grantor as a party. is the church likely to prevail? A, no, because the grantor's interest prevents the church's title from being marketable. B, no, because the quoted provision is a valid restrictive covenant. C, yes, because a charitable trust to support religion will attach to the proceeds of the sale. Or D, yes, because the grantor cannot derogate from his warranty to...
Interesting. I'm going to go with E. The guy was kind of a dick about religion, so therefore I'm not going to decide. I don't need... I've learned from the Supreme Court that you don't actually have to answer any legal questions. You can just say somebody in there was mean to somebody else in a loose way, and therefore... No, I don't care. Whatever. Is that a... Can I pick that answer? That
you can, I mean, pick. You can Supreme Court pick that does answer, that. You know.
Well, I'm as an aspiring lawyer, the Supreme Court does that. So, like, I would think that's a good example. I mean, who? It's like saying, oh no, you know, LeBron James does this in basketball, but you can't do that at all. Like, no, I would be looking to the top person to for an example, right? Am I crazy?
I
need to answer the question.
I mean, Thomas, you should apply some of the things that we were just talking about, because I think it's very, very clear based on the facts here that this grantor was hostile to the religion of the church.
Right. Yeah.
And therefore the whole provision is unenforceable. I mean, I think it's very clear under the masterpiece rubric.
Choice E. That's what I'm saying. Answer E. Okay. Let me try to actually answer this.
Yeah, this is why real property is awful, because in terms of legalese, it's one of the worst subject areas.
I'm gonna have to use the force on this one. If the church is not going to prevail because the grantor, when it says the quoted provision, isn't that the thing the grantor said?
Right, the church quote and its successors forever, so long as the premises are used for church purposes. That's the quoted provision.
For the record, every lawyer would be digging into their real property for this one, in all likelihood. I mean,
okay. So all that joking aside, this is an impossible question, and I have no idea. So Andrew Torres wanted to embarrass me in front of my friend Andrew Seidel. So Andrew, this is a nice prank, buddy. Make me look like an idiot in front of our guest. But no, I have absolutely. I cannot puzzle through this language. It doesn't make any sense to me as a non-lawyer. I can't even. You know, most of the time I can follow the logic and see, like, okay, what is it asking? I can't even do that in this case because it's too impenetrable for me. So my instinct is, they're saying the buyer has refused to close relating to quality. So like the contract they wrote, if I can even try to translate this, is the church wants to sell it. They want to sell the land that the grantor said it always has to be used for the church and you own it forever. As long as it's a church or something. And then the buyer wanted to use the land for something else. And then the contract, it says contract contained no provision related to the quality of the title. And there's no statute. I don't even know what that would mean. Like what the statute
just
would
a
be.
Law.
And then the buyer.
Yeah, you can throw that away. Like, throw that away. Ignore
that's
that.
What I mean. Like there's no law. What would the law be? But anyway, when the buyer refused to close, the church sued the buyer. So the buyer was like, why did the buyer? Okay,
the buyer,
I don't know.
The buyer
I don't
was
know.
Worried
the
about
answer
the title
is, I don't know.
And said,
I'm going to go. Right. I'm going to guess answer at random. Let's say D. I'll just say for some stupid reason, the D. I 100% cannot follow the logic of what it's asking. I'm not a lawyer, and this question is embarrassing me. So you win, bar exam.
Well, you,
I would have skipped
But
it.
You should still always guess, just for everybody out there listening.
That's right.
Yeah, oh, okay. So I at random, I see, my instinct is a no.
So guess one of the no's
answer.
Then.
Well, all right, I'll guess one. I think you're giving me a hint.
No,
all right. My instinct is a no, but I think that, you know what? I'm going with A. I take it back. A makes the most sense to me. If there's some grantor who like died or whatever a long time ago, I think, right? Or I don't know. And it said his successors forever. I feel like that ruins the title from being marketable. And that this makes some sort of sense. So A is my answer. Final answer, I eliminate every other possible answer in the universe. A is definitely the answer, and I'm done. Okay, Andrew Seidel, tell me what the hell this even is.
Okay, so first of all, real property, again, is awful. And the nomenclature and legalese in it is terrible. And I'm going to try to avoid using it. But I think this, I hope it is. I think this is a good example of like working through a bar question that you just did. Like you went with your gut, first of all, and I think you got the right answer. I mean, you went from a 1-4 shot to a 1-2 shot and got it. I mean, so my reading of this is that I also agree that I think it's A, and because I think this is a legitimate restriction. I recall seeing something like this once upon a time in a case book. So it has to be used for church purposes. And so if it is a legitimate restriction, that means when the church sells it to not be used for that, it automatically goes back to the person who sent it. Who deeded the property over, which is the grantor's interest that A is talking about, which means that the church could not have sold it. So this is one of those automatic reversions. I don't remember whether it's fee simple whatever or fee simple whatnot. I don't remember all those kind of things, and nobody cares.
So why wouldn't you think it's anyway. B then? Because I think I actually, even though you said I might have arrived at the right answer, I don't think I understood even what my answer was. I think
then you're down to choosing which one is the better one. And this is talking about buying right. and selling. So you want to go with something that deals with marketable, number one. And because I think this is trying to get at the interest automatically reverting is my suspicion. But that's
something I wouldn't know. All right. Well, I appreciate it. Sounds like you know at least something.
No, there's a very good chance we're both wrong. So I mean, it's 3-4 chance.
All right. I went with A. You also are going with A?
I'm going with A. Yes.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. We're going down on this ship together. You know, we're both equally capable lawyers. We both guessed A.
Thomas,
and
that's we're sailing off into the sunset on this ship together.
Oh, my gosh. All right. Well, you guys know how to play. This is going to be fun. I really was flustered on this one.
Well, I think it is. That's part of the real property problem is just the nomenclature and, you know, all these, right. all the different vocabulary on it is meant to make it very difficult.
Well, thank you for trying to make me feel better, but I'm glad we guessed the same answer, and we'll see if we're both wrong. That's my favorite. So you guys know how to play. Just share it, share and quote. And give your answer, and we'll pick a winner, of course, and you can do it on Facebook as well. And we will bathe that winner in riches and fame and fortune and all that. That's not guaranteed. All right, that does it for today's episode. I want to thank Andrew Seidel again for coming on. And again, reminder, our conversation will continue over on Serious Inquiries Only. We have a lot to talk about. I can't wait. Thanks, Andrew Torres, for being a lawyer and embarrassing me in front of my friend with this question. I appreciate you doing that. I'm definitely not mad. I'm definitely not harboring any sort of grudge over this. But yeah, that being said, it's been another great Rapid Response Friday, and we'll see you on Tuesday.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.
If you want to see chaos, Zeke, you should come to my house early in the morning when my three kids are running around. That's chaos. This is
I actually liked the way that Sarah Huckabee Sanders said it